And these feminists cornered me with my back against the wall, practically spitting in my face, and said, art, art, nothing that demeans women can be art. Mm. Now, how can you have any, as a student of art history, how can anyone have any dialogue with people who have such a, what is that? That is the Nazi and Stalinist view of art, okay, where art is subordinate to a prefab political agenda.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Camille Paglia. She's a cultural critic, an art critic, a literature critic, a teacher at University of the Arts in Philadelphia, where we're filming. She's best known as the author of Sexual Personae, a great book that came out in 1990. More recent work includes Break, Blow, Burn, a reading of 43 of the world's best poems from 2005, and Glittering Images, a journey through art from Egypt to Star Wars in 2012. Camille, thanks for talking to us.
Well, it's great to see you.
Let's talk about the contemporary state, or the state of contemporary feminism. You have been at, in a public life or in an intellectual life since the late 60s, a proud feminist, often reviled by other feminists. Gloria Steinem, I guess, most famously said that you were an anti-feminist, and that when you denied that, that would be like she said, a Nazi saying they're not anti-Semitic. Mm. You're mixing it up. What is going on with the state of kind of professional feminism in this country? It seems if you look at from, say, the early 70s or whatever benchmark you want to look at, things have gotten better for women. Men are less uptight about gender roles. Women are more in the workforce. They get paid equally. Sexual assaults and sexual violence are down. In so many ways, things are going better than ever. And yet, from sites like Jezebel or Feministing, all you hear is that things have never been worse.
Well, feminism has gone through many phases. I mean, obviously, the woman suffrage movement of the 19th century fizzled after women gained the right to vote through the Constitutional Amendment in 1920. And then the movement revived in the late 1960s through Betty Friedan, co-founding NOW in 1967. And now, I preceded all that. I'm on record, and there's a letter in Newsweek. I was in high school in 1963, where I called for equal rights for American women and so on. So I began thinking about gender and researching it. I loved the generation of Amelia Earhart and all those emancipated women of the 20s and 30s. Because I had started my process of thought about gender so much earlier, I was out of sync with the women's movement when it suddenly burst forth.
Talk a little bit about what it was like to grow up. I mean, you were living in upstate New York. Was your sexuality, did you already know what your sexuality was? But what was it like to be a woman? What was it like to be a lesbian in 1963?
Well, in the 1950s were a highly conformist period where the gender had repolarized after really great gains, it seems to me, in the 20s and 30s. And the reason for that one must be more sympathetic to the situation of my parents' generation. They had known nothing but depression and war throughout their entire lives. Everyone returned from the army. My father got out of he was a paratrooper, got out of the army. Everyone married, and I'm the baby boom. Okay, mm-hmm. Part of that generation. That was the result of that. They wanted normality. They just wanted to live like real people, man and wife in a home. I found the 1950s utterly suffocating. Okay? I was a gender non-conforming entity, right? And I was signaling my rebellion by these transgender Halloween costumes. They were absolutely unheard of. I was like 5, 6, 7, and 8. My parents allowed me to do it because I was.
What were you dressing up as?
A Roman soldier, the matador from Carmen. My best was Napoleon. I was Hamlet from the classics comics book and so on. Absolutely no one was doing anything like this. Right? So I'm happy that this talk about medical sex changes, mm-hmm. surgical sex changes, was not in the air, because I would have become obsessed with that and assumed that was my entire identity, right, and problem. So this is why I am very concerned about the rush to surgical interventions today. So at any rate, by the time I had any consciousness of being, I was attracted to men. I dated men, but I just fell in love with women. Always have. Okay. So yes, there's absolutely no doubt. I was on the forefront of gay identification when I arrived in graduate school at Yale, 1968 to 72, I was the only openly gay person at the Yale Graduate School, and I didn't even have a sex life. Okay, me, it was a badge of militance. So, and I was the only person doing a dissertation on a sexual topic. It's hard to believe this now.
Okay, what was the
Sexual Personae, which is the book which finally got published in 1990 after being rejected by 7 publishers and 5 agents. I'm delighted. I had the sponsorship of Harold Bloom that pushed the topic through the English department. I think possibly, you know, that they allowed me to do such a thing on sex was actually kind of amazing.
We'll come back to him because I think he's one of the villains of the current cultural scene.
But all right.
But
anyway, my clashes with other feminists began immediately. Because, for example, there was it was 1970, I believe it was, or 71. There was a feminist conference at the Yale Law School, and major feminists were there, including Rita Mae Brown, who said to me, you know, the difference between you and me, Camille, is that you want to save the universities and I want to burn them down. I mean, how can you have dialogue with these people? Okay, later she became a rich lesbian novelist and has a horse farm in Virginia. And then I had a screaming fight, with the New Haven Women's Liberation Rock Band over the Rolling Stones, because at that time hard rock was defined as sexist. Now this argument seems so retrograde now.
Although it's true, right? I mean, the guitar is a phallus. God is Dionysius. He's not a woman.
But at that time there were no women musicians. Right. That's why Patti Smith was so radical when she appeared in her Frank Sinatra garb for Mapplethorpe on the front of Horses. We had this screaming fight about Under My Thumb. The song, and I said yes, the lyrics of Under My Thumb are sexist, but this song is a great song. This is a work of art, and so on. And these feminists cornered me with my back against the wall, practically spitting in my face, and said, Art, nothing that demeans women can be art. Now, how can you have any, as a student of art history, how can anyone have any dialogue with people who have such a, what is that? That is the Nazi and Stalinist view of art, where art is subordinate to a prefab political agenda. Next was the argument over hormones, Again, screaming argument, over hormones. Well, I was told by the founding members of the Women's Studies Department in the State University of New York at Albany that I had been brainwashed by male scientists to believe that hormones even existed, much less had any role in the shaping of our identity and our character. So I was banned from the women's movement from the start, but I kept going on. I was pro-pornography, pro-prostitution, on libertarian grounds. But later there will be a word for this, and so on. for years, finally, my wing of feminism, which had been silenced all that time, we were silenced and ostracized by the Steinem wing, the establishment wing, partisans of the Democratic Party, my party, but nevertheless, I don't feel that feminism should have been subordinated to any party. Finally, we rose, in the 90s, and the pro-sex wing of feminism won in the 90s, thanks to Madonna having changed the culture.
Okay, stop for a second. Let's define, what is the essence of feminism? Is it using the lens of gender to explore every given issue, or is it a set of political positions that can't change?
Well, my view, I am an equal opportunity feminist, I believe that all barriers to women's advance in the social and political realm must be removed. However, I do not feel that gender, is sufficient to explain all of human life, the gender myopia, the gender monomania, has become a disease. It's become a substitute for a religion, It's become a whole cosmic view that it is impossible, the feminist agenda can ever be the total explanation for human life. This is our problem now, is this monomania, the identity politics of the 1970s. Yeah. So people see everything through the lens of race or gender or social class. This is a madness, an absolute madness. And in fact, it's a distortion of the 60s, absolute distortion.
And you're not saying that those things, race, class, and gender, which is kind of the holy trilogy or holy trinity of contemporary cultural studies, but all of those things are important and they all intersect many ways. But you're essentially arguing that none of these explain things totally.
That's right. That's right. These are techniques of social analysis I find very useful. That's the way I teach. It's the way I write. And all these race, class, and gender, absolutely.
So talk
about.
But
the point is, these are Marxism. As I argue in the introduction to my last book, Glittering Images, is not sufficient as a metaphysical system for explaining the cosmos. It is very limited. Marxism sees only society, but we are much greater than that. There's nature, there's eternity, there's questions of mortality, which Catholic theology of the Middle Ages addressed far more profoundly than Marxism ever has.
And of course, one of the foundational texts, I guess, is a second wave feminism, The Dialectic of Sex by Shulamith Firestone. literally just took a class out of the Marxist analysis and put in gender, and then did the same thing. And so you're saying, I mean, there's some power in those moves, but they're limited.
Yes, that's right. These are simply tools. They're tools, okay? But we should have a large toolbox, okay?
And wait, is that the lesbian you're talking? That you want a large toolbox?
Okay. No, it's actually ex-Catholic. Yeah, okay, I'm an atheist. Yeah. Okay, but there's no doubt that I see things theologically, and that I was profoundly influenced by Hinduism and Buddhism when I was in college at Harper College, upstate New York. These ideas were everywhere. I feel that the '60s had a vision, a large cosmic perspective that was absolutely lost in this degeneration. Okay, in this splintering of the 1970s into these identity politics.
Drove that? Was it just that the revolution eats its own, or is it there was a shrinking economic pie, so people started grabbing for whatever they could before the Titanic went down? What explains
my
that,
explanation?
That kind of narrowing of a cosmic vision into something more.
My explanation, I actually wrote an entire essay, okay, about the religious vision of the American 1960s. And this is it's an essay called Cults and Cosmic Consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I feel, okay, that the real visionary thinkers of my generation destroyed their brains on drugs. Okay, I think LSD just leveled all the truly talented
people
of my generation.
This conversation is over. Okay. But So you think? I mean, it was who are the people who destroyed themselves on drugs?
My classmates. People. I think the authentic imaginations, the really innovative people of my generation, the most daring, of my generation, took the drug. Now, I for some reason, felt that the LSD was untested, and I did not want to experiment with it. And I was interested in all such vision quest, things at the time. I went up with fellow students to see Timothy Leary speak at Cornell. I saw him, and it made me uneasy. He was the guru. There was such a crowd around him. He was such a magnetic, but his face was already twitching. I could see. I said, this is not going to end well, and it did not. When I got to graduate school in 1968, I can attest to the fact that no authentically radical student of the 1960s ever went to graduate school. So all that were left were the time servers who parasitically battened on the achievements of the 60s. For heaven's sake, here's an example. When I had applied to graduate schools, I applied to six or seven graduate schools, and
you didn't get into the one you wanted, so you went to Yale.
I made the choice for Yale because of the library. I felt that I needed the tremendous research library. But I also applied to Buffalo, and I thought of going to Buffalo. Leslie Fiedler was there. Norman Holland was there. Mm-hmm. So I could easily have gone to Buffalo. At any rate, I was confronted by the leader of the campus radicals on the quad. He said, I heard you're going to Yale. He said, you don't do that. I said, in graduate school, that's not where it's happening. He did allow that if I were to go to graduate school, I should go to Buffalo. That was the only thing he permitted. And so on. Right. But these people, the idea that there were any tenured radicals is Roger Kimball's phrase.
Right.
This is not true. There was not the only Todd. Gibbon, he's the absolutely only one.
And Todd Gitlin, who was the leader of students for Democratic Society.
Yes.
So, there weren't tenured radicals; there were tenured bureaucrats or apparatchiks.
Here's the thing. Any authentic leftist, who had a job at a university in the 1970s or 80s or 90s, should have been opposing the entire evolution, of the universities, that is toward this administrative bureaucracy that has totally robbed power from the faculty, The total speciousness and fraud of academic leftism is proved by the passivity of these people in every department of the university to that power play that happened. My first job at Bennington, we rose, 1976, we rose, the faculty, voted, no confidence in the president, into fight back against the board, we rejected the power of the board, And where has there ever been after any such uprising?
Two questions. One is that I actually think you're right that universities travel on their faculty, and the faculty, Various studies have shown that there has not been a growth in the number of faculty, certainly not of tenure-track faculty, but the big growth in employment in universities is in administrators.
Absolutely.
And whatnot.
And but salaries.
If you went to college up through about the mid-80s, and certainly from the late 60s through about the mid-80s, there was no in loco parentis. There were fewer and fewer required courses. It was a kind of temporary autonomous zone.
Right.
Then it started getting ratcheted down, and now when you hear about the student experience, it's about required courses, and it's about making people think certain things or not express certain things, and it's so much of the focus of undergraduate education seems to be on kind of indoctrinating people into
That's
the
right.
proper ways of thinking.
That's right.
How does that play into this passivity on the part of the faculty? I mean, is it that the faculty wants to see that happen, and so they're happy to have bureaucrats
Absolutely.
Run
all,
things?
All I can say is that once again, the people who went into teaching, who went to graduate school, are just followers, they're sheep, as far as I'm concerned, Let me just say something about the in loco parentis, because when I arrived in college, 1964, the in loco parentis was operative. I was in a girl's dorm. We had a sign in at 11 o'clock at night. The boys could run free. They had panty raids. We'd throw water at them, out the windows and so on. My generation of women rose up and said, get out, of our private lives. And the university said, no, the world is dangerous. We must protect you against rape, against attack, all those things. And we said, Give us freedom to risk rape. That is the true freedom.
Isn't it true, though, that what they were trying to restrain was not rape, but rather your sexual appetite?
Well, I think that they believed they were acting for the parents. It was their obligation to protect. And so now everything, and that this is why I went so much against the grain of contemporary feminism when I wrote about the date rape, hysteria. I wrote this inflammatory piece for Newsday in 1991. I'm still being persecuted about it, everywhere. People are still angry about it. And basically, what I said was, free women must take personal responsibility for their own sex lives. And they keep authority figures out of
and to be clear,
your sex life.
In no way is this sanctioning sexual violence. What you're talking
Absolutely.
About are cases where people retroactively reclassify
yes.
something, a regrettable sexual experience that they would rather have not consented
yes.
to.
I'm talking about date rape,
which
is what everyone is talking about and right now, about the so-called rape culture. But that essay that I wrote begins, rape is an outrage that cannot be tolerated in any civilized society. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this new reclassification, of people getting drunk, going on a date, going to fraternity houses, and women not taking responsibility for their own behavior, I said the gay men for thousands of years have been going out and having sex with strangers everywhere. They know they can be beaten up. They know they can be killed. What is this? Where women are like, we must be protected against even our foolish choices. It's up to men to do. This is ridiculous. This is an intrusion. Into the civil liberties of young people to have this kind of vampiric parent figures in the administrators hovering over, watching, supervising people's sex lives. In Europe, there's nothing like this. There's no idea that the University of Paris is concerned about the dating lives of the damn students.
Well, they don't have sports teams and they don't have dorms.
It's this residential college thing. This vision of college as summer camp, as Club Med. This is the folly
but it's actually,
of
it's
American
more,
education.
It's more re-education camp now, right?
Camp
Wojciecha rather
than.
Hand.
Let us give you the incredible gym with the exercise equipment. Let us give you the 1,000 choices in the cafeteria. This has nothing to do with education anymore. Maleducation. Is being committed from coast to coast in the United States.
Talk a little bit about Madonna's effect on the culture, which we're still feeling. I mean, one of the most interesting things, and I've talked to people about this, before and after Madonna, every Hollywood movie, and many popular novels, many artistic novels have, it's all about virgin whore. A woman can only be a virgin or a whore. Madonna obviously played with that. And in her wake, it just seems like the virgin whore complex, which bedeviled Western civilization for centuries, it doesn't really seem to matter anymore.
Well, Madonna's great period was 1983 to 1992. She absolutely changed the world. There's no doubt about it. And since then, it's cringe making. But the current Madonna it's embarrassing.
I think you will agree that when she started faking the English accent, the real Madonna died every bit as much as Elvis died when he went into the army.
But what Madonna did is to allow young women to flirt with men, to seduce men, to control men. Okay. Now she showed that you could be sexy, but at the same time control the negotiations, control the territory between male and female, and it was really powerful. Okay, very powerful. And so now we're in a period. I mean, this is what I don't understand. Okay, where we have some of the women on campus, the whining, there's institutionalized whining now. Okay, about it. That's what it's turned into.
Well, clarify. What's the difference between a legitimate gripe and whining?
Well, in my point of view, okay, no college administration, okay, should be taking any interest whatever, okay, in the social lives of the students. None, okay. If a crime is committed on campus, it should always have been reported to the police.
Right.
Okay? I absolutely do not agree about any committees investigating any charge of sexual assault. Okay, either it's a real crime or it's not a real crime. Get the hell out, okay, and so on. So you get the expansion of the campus bureaucracy, okay, with this. It's absolutely Stalin. Okay, oversight and microscope, but the students have been raised with helicopter parents. They want it. The students of today, okay, they're utterly unformed. Okay, not necessarily in my school, the art school. I'm talking about the elite schools.
Those kids over at that other school.
It's the grade grubbers.
Yeah, okay?
It's the grade grubbers. The bright overachievers. I'm not at that kind of school. Okay, I'm at a school of arts and communication. Okay, where people already have a vocational trend. Okay, to be admitted here, you have to already have a vocational aptitude, okay? I'm talking about the Ivy League. Now I've encountered these graduates, okay, of Harvard, Yale, University of Pennsylvania, and Princeton. I encounter them in the media, okay, and people in their 30s now, some of them, okay, their minds are like jello. They know nothing. They've not been trained in history, okay. They have absolutely no structure to their minds. Their emotions are unfixed, okay. So it's in the banality of contemporary cultural criticism, okay, of academe, okay. The absolute collapse, okay, of any kind of intellectual discourse in the U.S. is the result of these colleges, okay, which should have been the best, okay, and have produced the finest minds, instead having retracted into caretaking. The whole thing is about approved social positions and a kind of misty love of humanity, okay, without any direct knowledge, okay, of history or economics or anthropology.
Maybe the university is not the place where that sort of stuff is happening anymore. So, for instance, you have think tanks that do a lot of economic or policy work. You have popular historians who are not academic, are not academic. I mean, fiction and poetry, even as there's been a rise of a kind of, for decades now, creative writing programs and whatnot, nobody looks to the university to be cutting edge on, on almost anything, really. So maybe it's just that you picked the wrong, maybe you should have followed the campus radicals suggestion and not gone into academia.
Well, I mean, in terms of as a writer of cultural criticism, okay, I find that I'm happiest when I'm writing for, let's say, the British press. I write quite a bit for the Sunday Times magazine in London, and I find that the general sense of cultural awareness, okay, that I can have an authentic discourse about ideas, okay, with international journalists, okay, from Brazil or Germany or Italy or Norway, okay, or Canada even, okay. Somewhat, okay, but they have a PC problem themselves. So I can feel, okay, the vacuum, okay, right, in the nothingness, okay, of American cultural criticism at the present time. It is impossible.
And
any journalist of today, an American journalist, you cannot have any kind of a deep discussion of
ideas.
Is
that just a kind of hyper exaggeration of the American disease, which is that we've never, and I mean, this goes back to, early American literary criticism that we're people who come from nowhere, and we don't care about the past. We're freed from the burdens of the past, but we don't care about the past.
Yes, yes. I think this is true. The past is always present, okay, in Europe. To the extent that you're in Berlin, you can see the bullet marks still on the buildings from World War II, and so on. It's a terrible burden, okay, to have that there. Okay, I think Americans are far more ingenious and open and daring. Okay, on the other hand, the nature of our politics too, the way we keep on having the two big parties with their big tent and their internal gradations, of affiliation, whereas people abroad, okay, have a much more sophisticated idea about your a person's specific intellectual and political positions. They can identify, because they'll have 13 parties, conflicting in parliament and so on. So I think that's been a problem over here, is that it's either or. Okay, you're either a liberal or conservative, and what you're combining things from both sides, and then obviously you're a traitor against one. It's like it's become like a substitute for religion, whether mm-hmm. you're a Democrat or a Republican over here. Okay, and there was a period where I felt it, there was as that you had the first conservative challenge coming from talk radio. Okay, to in the early 90s to the liberal hegemony in the mainstream media. I thought that was a very exciting period because you started to get the clash of ideas.
Right.
But now the right itself has become a victim of its own insularity, and I no longer feel that dialogue anymore.
You did not exist, as you were talking about, in the mid 60s. Your subject, your cultural identity did not exist. And now you are, there's a million types of people that you could be. You can be a conservative lesbian. You can be, polyamorous. You can be bisexual. You can be this. You can be that.
Yes.
Would you agree that there's been a massive proliferation of legitimate cultural identities that are out there? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? And what's driving that move forward?
Well, at first I was very excited about the ethnic identity movement mm-hmm. because I feel very Italian American, and I've always been in revolt against the WASP style mm-hmm. that dominated academia when I first. Lizzie Fiedler himself was
right.
a victim of this. Harold Bloom was. And there weren't even any Jews hired in the Yale English department until like the mid 1950s, and there were quotas on Jewish students admitted to Harvard. I mean, all things like that. But over time, okay, what's happened? I think okay that gender identity has become really almost fascist. Okay, and it's to me a very shrunken, miniaturized way of perceiving your position in the world and in the universe. Okay, there was a time when these fine gradations of gender identity. Okay, I'm a male trans doing this with that going move. This is a symptom of decadence. I'm sorry. As my sexual persona talks about this. That was in fact the inspiration of sexual persona was that my overview of history and my noticing in late phases
right.
you all of a sudden get a proliferation of homosexuality, of sadomasochism, okay, mm-hmm. of gender games and impersonations and masks and so on. So
and
I believe we're in a late phase of culture.
So that the proliferation of cultural identities, the proliferation of all sorts of possibilities is actually a sign that we're
on the verge of collapse.
Yeah.
Yes, Western culture is in decline. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Okay, in my view. Okay, it's looking at the history of Egypt, of mm-hmm. Babylon. Okay, mm-hmm. Of Rome, of Byzantium.
Yeah.
Okay, and so on. So what's happening is the busy. Everyone's so busy. Okay, with themselves. Okay, with the solipsistic, narcissistic, a sense of who they are in terms of sexual orientation or gender, and this intense gender consciousness, women consciousness mm-hmm. at the same time. And meanwhile.
Is that also racial consciousness or ethnic consciousness as well?
I think right now, okay, to me, the real obsessions have to do with gender orientation. Although I think there's been this flare-up, I voted for Obama, okay, but I've been bitterly disappointed. I think we had hoped that he would inaugurate a period of racial harmony, and mm-hmm. I think it's actually the situation has become even worse, okay, over the past for recent years. It seems to be overt inflammatory actions by the administration mm-hmm. to pit the races against each other in the U.S. So I think there's a lot of damage that needs to be healed, but I think most of the problems as I perceive them, okay, mm-hmm. as I can see them in my students and so on, is that there is a new obsession, okay, with where you are on this wide gender spectrum, okay, mm-hmm. and in a view of gender that seems to me unrealistic because it is so divorced from any kind of biological referent. I mean, I do believe in biology. I do believe in the cult. I say the first paragraph of sexual persona. That sexuality is an intricate intersection of nature and culture. But what's happened now is that the way the universities are teaching is nothing but culture, okay? And nothing's from biology. It's madness. It's a form of madness, okay? Because women who want to marry and have children, okay, are going to have to encounter their own hormonal realities at a certain point. Okay.
But I mean, so do you see your personal liberation was that helped grease the skids for decadence or for the collapse of Western civilization?
I have, yes.
Do you feel at all ambivalent about that?
I've defined myself as a decadent. Okay,
yeah.
One of my first influences was Oscar Wilde.
Right.
I stumbled on a little book called The Epigrams of Oscar Wilde in a secondhand bookstore in Syracuse, New York, and I was like 14. Right, and I was fascinated by his statement. So I am a Wildean, and he identifies himself as a kind of decadent. you know, right. That period of aestheticism and decadence.
And certainly he was towards the end of the great hegemony of England as a world power,
yes,
as a cultural
that's
power.
That's true, too. Yeah. Yes, the decline of the empire. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely right.
So, you know, somebody like Leslie Fiedler, who taught for years at Buffalo and before that, University of Montana, he wrote about freaks. He wrote about... you know, he did not seem to see it as a sign of decadence, though. Wasn't it kind of a delivery on, you know, the promise of an America where you could be an individual and where you could kind of create new forms of existence and new forms of identity?
Well, to me, Fiedler was one of the myth critics. Mm-hmm. Okay, there was a whole view. I mean, Northrop Frye,
right.
You know, was a huge influence on me. And the myth critics had this enormous view of history and of culture, and it's partly influenced by Jung. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Jung's.
Yeah. We're talking archetypes here of.
Yes.
Right.
This kind of syncretism, right. And seeing all the religions of the world, mm-hmm. all the cultures of the world, so that broad vision to me is the authentic multiculturalism. Okay, mm-hmm. Leslie Fiedler had it. There's the formula. Okay, mm-hmm. He honored also the great writers. Okay, mm-hmm. He worked in Chaucer, for example. He worked in John Donne. Okay, mm-hmm. All right. He didn't have any fetish about, you know, the dead white European males. He,
right.
He understood that that vitality has switched over to America.
Yeah.
Right, but he was omnivorous.
My own concerns have changed, and they center in a place where on a topic which I think everybody has to worry about now, which is the relationship between what we've come to call high culture mm-hmm. and popular culture. And what I'm interested in doing is blowing up that distinction completely.
The people today have what they practice, this new historicism, I call it this yuppie buffet style, where you take a little here, a little this, a little this, you juxtapose them, you make cutesy remarks, and that's it.
Okay?
There's no deep learning any longer.
Okay, well, yeah, let's talk about that. And
that's a Jewish style.
Yeah.
The Jewish style of Fiedler or of Harold Bloom, yeah. Okay, is deep erudition.
Well, here's something interesting. The movie version of 50 Shades of Grey
yes.
is out.
Yes, yes.
Okay, it has been accused and valorized for mainstreaming BDSM.
Yeah.
It is always remarked upon as this is sub-literary. It's, you know, you take Ayn Rand and you dumb her down and you're still like a mile above where E.L. James is. Fiedler in particular, and this seems very distinct from somebody like Harold Bloom, he was famous for talking about the effect that text had on audiences. So that Gone with the Wind, which was just dismissed by real critics as chick lit, and it's not really literature. It's certainly no Faulkner. It tells us nothing about the South, etc. And Fiedler said, no, actually, you need to look at a book that makes you cry every time you read it, which is what he would say, and that has a hold on millions of people is meaningful.
Yep.
How does that square with, and obviously Sexual Persona, very much like a book like Love and Death in the American Novel, is this incredible work where you're grabbing from high and low, you're talking about the ancient, it's an incredibly learned book. How do you square great poems, like high and low, great and...
But the point is, I call for standards, but I take popular, for me, it's the great art, but also popular culture. But within those fields, I say this is good, this is not good,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's any difference, for me,
right.
in the Fiedler way. Okay, I respond to both. I always respond to the both. Okay,
right.
Great art. Okay, and also Elizabeth Taylor. Okay,
right.
And so on. At a time when she wasn't taken seriously, and I always follow my instincts and the pleasure principle.
What would be a way forward for colleges or other institutions to start, kind of making a defense of the humanities, I guess is what I'm asking. How do you've...
Oh, that's hopeless.
Yeah.
It's absolutely hopeless. The humanities destroyed themselves, okay, mm-hmm. with that veering toward postmodernism and post-structuralism. It's over, okay? They've been completely marginalized by deconstruction, by questioning and, undermining, okay, and throwing out the whole idea of the genius, of the mm-hmm. master, of great works of art. I believe that there are great works of art. I do not believe, that the canon is produced by critics sitting in a room to intensify their own power. I believe the canon is created by other artists. Okay, you identify the canon by who had the greatest influence on other artists over time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is the story. But about the whole historical tradition, the linear line, which I believe in, absolutely believe in terms of art history, has been discarded. Okay, the survey courses are being abandoned. Okay, no, the graduate students are not being trained even to think in large terms anymore. They have no sense of history, okay? But I find there's more sense of history, okay, in Southern evangelicals who didn't even finish high school, okay, because their knowledge is, of the world is based on the Bible, right? Mm-hmm. So they're thinking in terms of what happened 2,000 years ago, what happened 2,500 years ago.
So you think it's impossible to revivify the humanities?
How is it going to happen?
I'm asking you. I mean, you're making a pretty good case that it's helpful.
I want parents to rebel and stop paying these obscene prices. Okay.
Right.
I want the government is like, you know, put all that loan money flush into the colleges and drove up the tuition obscenely, et cetera. Okay. I want a return to vocational education. Okay. Right. I mean, when you get with people now being trained for real jobs.
Where then do people talk about ideas? You're not going to get history of ideas.
Forces the universities to pare down this ridiculously overinflated curriculum to what is necessary. Now, I had a very wonderful experience when I was finishing Sexual Personae, living in New Haven in the early 1980s, and I was teaching for the freshman courses, you know, of literature courses, basic, you know, great books courses, to night classes at the Sikorsky helicopter factory. Okay, mm-hmm. These are adults, okay, who are married with children. Some of them were middle age, okay? Just getting additional credits, all right? So these were night classes. I had to have like all the badges to get in on the security and so on. Fantastic, okay? All right? This is what should be done, okay? People have to live. People have to have, you know, have to have some way of supporting themselves, okay? This is ridiculous, like graduating kids with these crushing debts and no, what are we doing? We're releasing them into what? They're going to be working for McDonald's, okay? We should think in terms of careers. We should think of how we are preparing people to get jobs, okay, and not just getting jobs as the Ivy League does in finance, okay, or in law, okay, and the high ticket professions and so on. No, okay, I mean right now it's expected that you go to college. Why? Okay, my generation, the baby boomers, were the first where people were talking about that somehow college is a right. Okay, it used to be very few people went to college. My father was the first member of his family to go to college. He did it on the GI Bill and so on, okay? And I'm the direct beneficiary, you know, of it. But this whole idea, the abandonment of the core curriculum, okay, for this cafeteria style, way of education today, where people are just picking out these like crazy named
but
courses.
Is that really true? I mean, in the sense of, you know, there's no question that virtually every undergraduate, it has a much more structured curriculum now. They don't have a lot of options. They're told, if you talk to a typical English major, they have many more required courses. If you talk to for just general ed requirements, there are many more required courses than there were in the 70s.
Honestly, you're able to graduate, okay, with degrees in literature without having read in, you know, several of the major, you know, authors. I just don't think that's true. The survey courses are gone. Okay, there are very few places that have the survey courses any longer. Mm-hmm. Like where you could have an art history course that went two semesters, starting with Kvar and ending up with, you know, abstract modernism and so on. Those have been abandoned. Okay, and these are some of the best courses that were ever offered in the American university. With this great vision of things, okay, moving chronologically over time, showing influence and so on. Okay, they've been abandoned.
Talk a little bit about Salon. I mean, this is kind of fascinating you. And, you know, we're 20 years on from the beginning of Salon, essentially.
Yeah.
You were writing for Salon at a time when people like David Horowitz, the left-wing turned right-winger, was there. I mean, it was a much more kind of ecumenical place. I mean, the idea was that people should be interesting. Now we've hardened into, you know, what might be called the politics of exclusion and exhaustion, where it's like you're either a right winger or you're a left winger. You're a Weekly Standard neocon or you're a Salon, you know, PC warrior.
Right.
What is driving that kind of intensification of difference and of a failure, you know, an unwillingness to kind of brook any sort of overlap between these categories?
Well, first of all, I want to say about Salon is that Salon in this great period was you still had David Talbot, the main founder of Salon, in charge. Okay, and David Talbot's mind is very sophisticated, cosmopolitan. Okay, and he was interested in the full range of ideas. Mm-hmm. He had tremendous prescience. This was a great editor. Okay, at a certain point, he retired from direct management of the magazine. David Talbot's an imprint on Salon gradually faded, and it became. And what happened was, Today's Salon is it's like a collegiate magazine to me. Okay, the headlines are strident, you know, the it's like knee-jerk, predictable. Okay, mm-hmm. And I think it's very, very sad. I think it's one of the most tragic declines in the history of the contemporary media. Okay, mm-hmm. is what's happened to Salon.
What do you think more broadly about kind of ideology? You know, in the 21st century alone, just in the 15 years that we've had. Does libertarianism, is that a kind of political or ideological position that actually can offer something good to the future?
Well, it appears that, you know, Rand Paul has been you know, drawing excited kind of college crowds. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see whether the young people, okay, you know, have the kind of old style. Sense of identification with Democrat or Republican. I have the sense, it's not entirely a comfortable sense, okay, that you know, that my students have slowly morphed away from even paying attention to politics mm-hmm. over the past, let's say, 15 years, and it's worried me because the crises around the world are actually intensifying, and how are they going to cope as a generation?
Well, and to go back to that, I mean, you had mentioned that you're a Democrat. I assume your parents were Democrats. Have an intense brand loyalty.
My grandfather's generation were Democrats. My grandfather worked in the factory, the Endicott Johnson Shoe Factory, and they loved Roosevelt and so on. Okay, and then that generation, my parents' generation, it turned into kind of the shifted during the disorders of the 1960s, mm-hmm. and there was a shift toward the Republican
right.
in the 70s and so on. And I've always been a Democrat myself. Okay, but you know, I voted for Obama. I remain a registered Democrat, but I voted Green, okay, I voted for a woman president already, Jill Stein,
right.
okay, and so on, and I continue to send money to the Green Party, even though people might think, okay, since I'm a skeptic about global warming and so mm-hmm. on, that, what am I doing? But I honestly still believe that the Green Party is closer to the vision of the 1960s that I remember mm-hmm. than what the Democratic Party has become. Okay.
What, you know, when you're talking about students now, is it a bad thing that they are, you know, they're like, hey, forget politics? I mean, because there was a huge element of the 60s revolution, which was like, you know what, politics, that's old men, you know, duking it out and trying to throw our bodies in front of each other.
Right.
Is it a bad thing? I mean, because that's one of the promises of libertarianism, really, is that we squeeze politics down to the smallest sphere possible so we can get on with more meaningful parts of our lives.
Well, I'm just concerned if you're not interested at all in the news or in political sparring and in maneuverings and so on, then how can you possibly have any influence on the future? I'm worried that we're heading toward a kind of Big Brother empire, okay, where you have people, you know, the sort of career politicians at the top in league with the puppet masters of the media, okay, and the ability to manage the news, the complete drop of journalistic standards now that the newspapers are like vanishing. I mean, no young person reads a newspaper, okay, that's mm-hmm. on the way out. So without staff, you know, of investigative reporters, how are you ever going to be able to get, you know, in-depth stories that might take a year to research, you know, so where it appeared now of instant news, the people who are reporting the news and writing the news don't even bother to say, they'll just report what a government official says as if it's the truth. You don't even have a disclaimer like such an official claimed. Okay, you just have total the media is acting as a total mouthpiece. Okay, and that bothered me during the run up to the Iraq War. I was like the only person who spoke out in Salon at length. Okay, against the Iraq War, everyone fell down on flat in front. What the government was saying.
How much of this is that your reading habits are attuned to a previous eras, so that, you know, you have groups like ProPublica, you have the Marshall Foundation, which is headed up by a former New York Times editor, you know, that looks at sentencing reform and is doing long-form criminal justice. I mean, because, you know, you're so relentlessly
negative. What you're saying has nothing to do whatever, okay, with the main forum, okay, of the news, okay? I am constantly monitoring the main forum, okay,
right.
of things. You know, I try to start with something that's in the news, and I'm able to monitor how aware the students are, okay? And I'm telling you, over the last 15 years, step by step by step, okay, it's getting worse and worse and worse. If I were at Yale or at Harvard, I'm sure the pre-law students are constantly monitoring the news, and they would know exactly what I'm talking about, okay?
But you would hate them for the way.
Arts.
Yeah.
This is the arts and communication. This is the future of arts and communication here, okay? Yeah. All right. That's the future of law, okay? And finance.
I'm thinking of like during my tenure at Reason, and I started in '93. I know that our venue, you know, our audience has grown, our influence, people at the Washington Post call us up, people at NPR, so in that main forum, it seems that alternative news sources, which do long-form reporting, we're actually growing in terms of our influence, mm-hmm. not necessarily on every issue. And there is, in many ways, when you look at the transformations in things like gay marriage equality, pot legalization, skepticism about war, it seems like, you're right, certainly before the Iraq war, there was nothing from the mainstream media. Yeah. But now people, there seems to be a skepticism forming, which has to be coming from somewhere.
Hey, okay, all I can say is, all right, when Hillary and her, Valkyrie warriors, got us into Libya, I didn't notice, okay, anything. Okay, I was absolutely, yeah. I wish I had in my Salon column to condemn that, okay, because here's the end result, okay, the total destabilization of Libya. Okay, so there was nothing, okay. Everyone fell down flat in front of that one too. Now, I think what libertarianism needs is a strong candidate. Rand Paul is just not taking seriously. Okay, if he really wants to run for president, he's just not taking anything seriously. I mean, the presidency is not just a post of power. It also is symbolic. Okay, and you have to look a certain way and you have to act a certain way. Okay?
Whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, what should a candidate look like, whether it's male or female?
Well, the huge impact on me was I was 13. Okay, when John F. Kennedy was running. Okay, so I mean, I went out and campaigned for him. I went downtown and I waved placards and so on. And this, you can't imagine what it was like coming out of the sleepy Eisenhower years. Okay, with mm-hmm. Mamie Eisenhower in the White House and so on. We didn't know why Eisenhower was like a great war hero. Yeah. We don't know anything of that. Okay, and this incredibly charismatic man. Okay, who didn't accomplish nothing, of course. Okay, but this whole ability to speak. I mean, when you look back, for a while I've been disillusioned, with JFK. But when I've looked back at some certain big documentaries that show him speaking on the road, when he was campaigning. That was a smart guy. In fact, his management of press conferences was incredible. Of course, he created the genre, but wow, he was like pinpoint and sharp, and he just puts everyone else to shame with their managed questions and their planned call list, list of people, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so like a sense of sprezzatura is important. What else goes into the perfect
candidate? He had been in the military. He had been in the Navy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the point is that's another thing that's a problem now. Okay, with contemporary politics is that in America, the whole generation of men that mm-hmm. had experience in the war, the realities of war, and had been abroad, had experienced the horrors and so on, it's going. And so we have all these guys who are products of Ivy League schools, and there's Harvard and Yale concentration of stuff. This is not good. Okay. Whereas in England, there's a tradition, of course, of the upper class, including the royal family, going into uniform. Okay. So there's a sense of commitment. Okay. The mm-hmm. ruling class has a sense about war. Okay. And military history and of sacrifice and so on. Now we have an entire country. The governing class has no. We're not going to have this professional army, and so the sufferings and the losses, are being stuck down onto others. And this is very dangerous to me, okay, because war is your encounter with historical reality and with elemental realities of life and death. Okay, so that to me is the explanation of the problem also with the left. Okay, is that because of this transformation, this slow change into this middle class culture that we inhabit now, the shrinking of the industrial base, okay, the migration of factories overseas. What has meant is that leftism has become totally armchair rhetoric, okay, with no direct contact with real working class people. Oh. Okay, now that
is it a bad thing if we don't have working class
people? I think that it gives me there's a sense of grounding because my grandparents' generation, all four grandparents were born in Italy. Right. Okay, in the countryside, they were farmers.
Yes.
Okay, all right. My mother was born there too. Okay, they came over here. One grandfather worked in the shoe factory. Okay, and I was like living in their home.
Hey, but you're free riding. You're free riding on. My father was. Yeah. I mean, all of our parents were factory
this is the difference, okay, to me in the leftists, okay, that I know in academe. They don't have this experience. Mm-hmm. They have never had any direct experience of working class life, most of them, almost overwhelmingly. But the leftists of the 60s did, okay? Their parents, okay, like mine, okay, they had experience of social mobility, okay? Mm-hmm. So, all of a sudden, okay, you know, I was born, my father was in college, okay? Mm-hmm. So I lived in this factory town. It's my first home, okay? My grandfather came back from the factory every day. The factories dominated. For Andy Warhol also, this is a very similar thing in Pittsburgh, okay, and so on. And so you get this populist feeling, okay, when you emerge from that. And then my father became a high school teacher, and eventually he became a college professor. It was long afterwards. I didn't have a television or telephone until I was 12, okay, for heaven's sakes. We didn't have any money. Okay, so the point is, this gives you reality. It gives you a sense of practicality. I'm just one generation removed from the farmland, okay, et cetera, right? And this is what's missing. This the middle class academic, leftists, all these people, they know nothing actually, okay, but they have this distant sense of the working class, very condescending, okay, mm-hmm. about work, and they are somehow empowered. They are destined to help, okay, from the point of view of an intrusion of state authority, okay, this vast complex, this octopus of state authority that's going to help, the poor people. Okay?
So does a similar dynamic work, or how does that work on the right? Or you're not that interested in it because you're coming out of a left?
I feel there has definitely been a kind of a fossilization, of authentic analysis, a kind of jibing, joking, snide thing about Obama and so on. I mean, I hated that about Bush and I hated it about Obama, okay? This thing about, this is the president, okay? He should be, I don't care what errors they make, and both of them have made huge errors. The position of president should be treated with some dignity. This degradation, of prestige of our institutions is very bad. Okay, the cynicism, the snarkiness.
Wait, and you're from the 1960s, and you're upset at the people taking pot shots at institutions.
No. I believe we should attack. You attack. You criticize. You don't demean. Okay. I don't want. I don't get this. No. Mm-hmm. I mean, it fatigues me to read. Okay. I love to read the commenters. Because I think it's a whole new genre now. And the jokes with Obama's name, Obama, and this and that, and Obamy, and or Romney as mittens. All this stuff coming from the Tea Party and so on. Oh, by the way, I respect the Tea Party. I don't demonize them. There's a way of snide way. Now I enjoy anti-Hillary jibes. I think that's a whole art form itself.
Wait,
I collect those.
What is it about? Is Hillary Clinton kind of your worst nightmare as a woman?
No, she's exactly my age.
Yeah.
Okay, I feel I know her completely. Okay,
right.
She has some Scranton background and so on. In fact, we are. Accents almost kind of the same and so on. I understand her completely. Okay, all right. So I see all the the games and the the falsehoods and so on and so forth. So I've enjoyed. I've made an entire career practically out of In fact, I wrote the cover story for the New Republic was Ice Queen Drag Queen. That was 1996, I think. It was way back there. And so
what is it about Hillary that bothers you?
She's a fraud. Okay. Yeah.
How is she a fraud?
She can't have an opinion without poll testing it and so on. All right. She's a liar. Okay. This is not a strong candidate for president, for our first woman president. To me, Dianne Feinstein should have presented herself.
What, are you kidding?
No, I don't care what I don't care what.
Okay.
I don't care what her views are. Okay. What I'm saying is, for the post of president, that's commander in chief, of the military, it's got to be a woman, who has a familiarity with military matters, and also has gravitas.
Yeah,
right?
Talk a little bit about the.
Dianne Feinstein, I first became aware of her, after those murders that occurred, in City Hall.
She certainly never let you forget that she was there.
No, but I have never forgotten because it was one of the great moments a woman took charge, of an scene of absolute chaos, in barbarous murder, all right, and the whole government was falling apart, and she came to the media and gave the news, and was steady. And I said, that's it, that's the formula, for the first woman president.
It's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
How do you communicate, how do you use the media to communicate, okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's up to, for a woman must communicate, she's gonna be a woman president. Right. She must communicate both strength, you know, reserve, and yet compassion, okay? What's that formula? And I've been waiting and waiting mm-hmm. and waiting for the formula. The only one who's had it in America, as far as I'm concerned, was Dianne Feinstein, okay, mm-hmm. all right? And she didn't put herself forward for whatever reason, okay, as president. But Hillary does not have it, okay? No. Hillary is a mess, okay? And we're going to reward with the presidency a woman who has enabled, okay, you know, the depredations and the exploitation of women, okay, by that corn pone husband first, and so on. I mean, it's like the way feminists have made themselves blind, okay, to Hillary's record, okay, mm. of trashing. You know, they were going to try to destroy Monica Lewinsky, right. And so on. I mean, it's a scandal. Anyone who believes in sexual harassment guidelines, okay, should have seen that the disparity of power between Clinton and Monica Lewinsky was one of the most grotesque ever, okay, in the history of sex crime. Okay, he's a sex criminal, okay, and so on. We're going to put that guy back in the White House, okay? Hillary has ridden on his coattails. This is not a woman who has her own career, made her own career. She's a woman who failed the bar exam in Washington, okay? All right, she couldn't. Yeah. The only reason she went to Arkansas, okay, and got a job in the Rose Law Firm was because her husband was, you know.
All right, let's. Because I'm an optimistic person, yes, and this is an optimistic country. Can you say something? What are you excited about or optimistic about in this twilight of the American century?
What am I optimistic about?
Yeah. Is there any reason for us to, you know, to be getting up other than to fight an existential battle against darkness?
Well, we're so isolated here in the United States geographically, you know, that, I mean...
We don't have to worry about the Japanese bombing us again, but now, I mean, what's like, good? Is anything good in your life?
I enjoy living in America. I could only live in America, okay? Because I feel that you can you know accept in academia. You can think whatever you want, okay? You know, I think it's still a very fertile area for an entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. I think you know people with new ideas, okay, can come out of nowhere, okay, and become millionaires overnight. And some of our most interesting people, successful people, did not graduate from college. Okay, everyone from Matt Drudge didn't go to college right. and ended up, and so on, like ruling the world of media, the Jobs. I mean, there's so many examples mm-hmm. So I'm an educator, okay, so I want the reform of education, okay, and I just feel that there should be, you know, more vocational training at the high school level to offer jobs, you know, training in the trades, okay, for people in the inner city, okay, who like directing people to them toward college makes absolutely no sense considering the utter dilution of the current college curriculum. Mm-hmm. I don't see what the point of that is unless someone already is showing talent or interest in going into law or medicine or something like that. I'm interested in that, okay, but the public primary school education is an absolute hash right now. Yeah. Absolute hash. I can see what the students don't know when they arrive, you know, in college, okay? I mean, the people who are teaching at Harvard and Yale are getting the products of private schools and all kinds of private tutoring and so on. They are not in tune with what's happening in the culture. I believe I am because the students who come to this art school are from every possible social level, okay? They're very, you know, very talented, working class, you know, jazz musicians and dancers, okay, that I get in the classroom. I have, you know, occasionally, you know, there might be a student from a private school every like 5 years. But mostly there are good suburban schools, but there are, you know, less good. So I know what they're getting in school, and it's basically zero. Okay, what they're getting is they're being taught don't bully. Okay, all right, you know, like everyone, okay, negotiate and compromise and so on. They have they've never been taught geography. They don't know world geography. Okay, and so on. All right, they know nothing about history.
Okay, so what are you optimistic about?
I America is like it's to me, okay, full of fresh and creative right. energies, okay, and so on. That we're being saddled by an incompetent, you know, government that's sort of sapping, sapping, you know. I mean, I think the less you think about the government, maybe the better. I know. I still feel, you know, I wouldn't live anywhere else but the United States. Okay, I adore the nature. My current project, by the way, is about Native American, Paleo Indian culture, okay? And that's where I am in my mind right now.
Okay, and let's end with that. What are you working on, and what's the thesis?
I'm interested in, okay, the actual Native American history that predates
right.
all this ideological,
right.
Warfare over genocide mm-hmm. and so on, okay? I'm talking about the period after, as the glaciers withdrew from the United States, okay? The Paleo-Indian period, which is like, 10,000 to 13,000 BC, I'm talking about. I'm very interested in the worldview, the metaphysic, the religion of that period, and I think I have some instinct for it because of my interest in history of religion. Okay, mm. I'm very interested in religion as an atheist. Okay, that's one of my ambitions. Okay, is to restore the prestige of religion. Okay, to secular humanism, which I think has gotten very cynical and it's gotten less and less creative. The less it thinks about religion.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Camille Paulin.
Thank you, Nick.
It has been a wonderful conversation. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.